Hello, this is Patty Young, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 9th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Rochester to demolish vacuum oil building. Remediation project at site to take up to 2 years. The former vacuum oil building at 5 Flint Street will be torn down as the City of Rochester and the State Department of Environmental Conservation continue efforts to remediate the brownfield site. The graffiti-marred building will be torn down using heavy construction equipment with dust control measures, then the concrete will be crushed. The last high-visibility structure at the site of the former oil refinery on the Genesee River will be demolished ahead of bigger plans for the site. This project represents another important step toward healing our riverfront and transforming a once-contaminated site into an asset for the people of Rochester, says Mayor Malik Evans in a statement. By cleaning up the land and restoring it for future use, we're protecting public health, honoring our environmental responsibility, and reconnecting our neighborhoods to the Genesee River. The project is part of the New York State Brownfield Cleanup Program, and work will be led by RUE, an environmental consulting and remediation firm. Demolition and concrete crushing are expected to take about 4 to 6 weeks to complete. The demolition debris will be held on site for possible reuse as approved for fill or subbase for road construction. Additional work at the site will take up to 2 years to complete and includes treating oil in place and excavating and disposing of contaminated soil, backfilling with clean soil, installing 2 feet of clean cover material across the site, which will be graded and seeded, development of a long-term site management plan, trail closures expected during remediation. As a result of the remediation project, parts of the Genesee River Trail between Violetta Street and South Plymouth Avenue will experience temporary closures. There will be weekly updates on the trail access and alternate routes on cityofrochester.gov/streetbeat. DHS, twice deported man charged in North Carolina train attack. Police in Charlotte, North Carolina, arrested a 33-year-old man in connection with a stabbing aboard a light rail train just 4 months after a Ukrainian refugee was killed in a separate attack on the city's transportation system. Authorities on December 6 charged Oscar Solorzano with 3 felonies, attempted first-degree murder, assault with a deadly weapon inflicting serious injury, and breaking and entering a motor vehicle, in addition to several misdemeanors. Solorzano is accused of breaking into a commuter train car and stabbing 24-year-old Kenyan Kareem Shamar Dobi with a large knife, according to court documents. An arrest warrant alleges Solorzano, appearing intoxicated, shouted unintelligibly at Dobi and challenged him to fight before stabbing him. Dobi was transported to a hospital where she was in critical but stable condition, according to police. Magistrate Judge Rebecca Howell wrote in court filings that Solorzano was in the United States illegally and had previously been deported. He is being held without bond. In a December 6 news release, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said it requested that local police hold Solorzano until federal authorities are able to take custody of him. According to the release, Solorzano is from Honduras and was removed from the United States in 2018. He was apprehended at the border in 2021 and was removed again before re-entering the country and at an unknown date and location. This heinous stabbing by this twice-removed illegal alien should have never happened. ICE lodged an arrest detainer to ensure Oscar Gerardo Solorzano Garcia is not released back into North Carolina neighborhoods, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said in a statement. Noem accused officials in North Carolina's Mecklenburg County of not cooperating with ICE enforcement in the past. The stabbing incident comes months after the fatal attack of a 23-year-old Ukrainian refugee on a Charlotte train car garnered national attention. The killing of Irina Zaretska led President Donald Trump to target Charlotte as part of his crime crackdown in Democratic-led cities. Federal agents arrested more than 130 undocumented immigrants in Charlotte as part of the crackdown, including several dozen with charges from driving under the influence to aggravated assault, according to the Department of Homeland Security. USA Today has not independently verified those figures. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein expressed gratitude for state law enforcement in a social media post responding to the December 5th attack. Overall rates of violent crime have declined in Charlotte this year, according to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. As of October, the city said it saw crime decrease 8% year over year, with a 20% decrease in violent crime, including homicides, rapes, robberies, and aggravated assaults. Warner Brothers Discovery fight heats up. Paramount's $108.4 billion hostile bid tops Netflix's. Paramount Skydance on December 8th launched a hostile bid worth $108.4 billion for Warner Brothers Discovery in a last-ditch effort to outbid Netflix and create a media powerhouse that would challenge the dominance of the streaming giant. Netflix had emerged victorious on December 5th from a weeks-long bidding war with Paramount and Comcast, securing a $72 billion equity deal for Warner Brothers Discovery's TV, film studios, and streaming assets. But Paramount's latest attempt means the jockeying for Warner Brothers and its prized HBO and DC Comics assets will not come to a conclusion swiftly. Paramount argued its $30 per share all-cash offer for Warner Brothers Discovery is superior to Netflix's bid, providing shareholders $18 billion more in cash and an easier path to regulatory approval. It also argued the combination of Paramount and Warner Brothers would be in the best interest of the creative community, movie theaters, and consumers, who would benefit from enhanced competition. "We believe our offer will create a stronger Hollywood," Paramount CEO David Ellison said in a statement. However, analysts noted that Paramount's offer comes with its own risks, including additional debt needed to make the transaction work. A Paramount-Warner Brothers combination would boost its dominant position in the studio business, giving it a greater market share than current leader Walt Disney Company, and add to fears of consolidation that have hit the industry hard in recent years. Warner Brothers Discovery and Netflix did not immediately respond to requests for comments on Paramount's deal. In a regulatory filing, Paramount said that the Ellison family, which owns Paramount, along with private equity firm Redbird, had agreed to backstop $40.7 billion in equity capital. The offer also includes financing from Affinity Partners, run by President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Other financing comes from the Saudi and Qatari Sovereign Wealth Funds and Lamad Holding Company, owned by the government of Abu Dhabi. Netflix's offer comes with a $5.8 billion breakup fee and was likely to face strong antitrust scrutiny. President Donald Trump raised questions about the offer over the weekend. The bid has already drawn criticism from bipartisan lawmakers and Hollywood unions over concerns it could lead to job cuts as well as higher prices for consumers. Reuters had already reported, citing sources familiar with the matter, that Paramount had raised its offer to $30 per share on December 4th for the entire company, but that the Warner Brothers board had concerns about the financing. Paramount maintained that it would be a champion of Hollywood and its talent, would remain committed to releasing movies in theaters, and that its path to regulatory approval would be faster than Netflix's. "Our proposal is superior to Netflix's in every dimension. Higher headline value, increased certainty in that value, greater regulatory certainty, and a pro-Hollywood, pro-consumer, and pro-competition future," Ellison said. In its appeal to shareholders, Paramount said it submitted six proposals over the course of 12 weeks, but Warner Brothers Discovery never engaged meaningfully with these proposals. The $30 cash offer represents a 139% premium over the company's undisturbed stock price and bests Netflix's $27.75 offer that mixes cash and stock. The Warner Brothers Discovery acquisition is far from over. Netflix is in the driver's seat, but there will be twists and turns before the finish line. Paramount will appeal to shareholders, regulators, and politicians to try to stymie Netflix. The battle could become prolonged, said eMarketer senior analyst Ross Benz. Paramount submitted multiple offers starting in September to forge an entertainment powerhouse capable of challenging Netflix and tech giants such as Apple that have expanded into media but faced rejections. The studio argued that the combination of its Paramount Plus streaming service with Warner Brothers HBO Max would position it for growth and create a meaningful competitor to Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, or Walt Disney's Disney Plus, offering consumers more choice. Paramount maintained that it would be a champion of Hollywood and its talent and would remain committed to releasing movies in theaters and would continue to do so if combined with Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers television networks, which include CNN and TNT, would be in a stronger position when united with Paramount's television portfolio, the studio argued. It had sent a letter to Warner Brothers questioning the sale process and alleging the company has abandoned a fair bidding process and predetermined Netflix as the winner. That followed reports that Warner Brothers management called the Netflix deal a slam dunk while speaking negatively about Paramount's offer. In an interview on CNBC on December 8th, Ellison said that there is an inherent bias against his company in the bidding. We will be the largest investor in this deal. We're literally sitting here today because we are fighting for our shareholders, and we're also fighting for the shareholders of Warner Brothers Discovery, Ellison said in the interview. Some analysts and industry experts see Paramount as the best candidate for acquiring Warner Brothers Discovery, given Ellison's deep pockets, backed by his father, Oracle co-founder, and the world's second richest person, Larry Ellison, who has close ties with the Trump administration. Bloomberg News has reported Trump met Netflix co-CEO Ted Sarandos in mid-November, telling the executive Warner Brothers should sell to the highest bidder. In his CNBC interview, David Ellison said he had great conversations with Trump, but did not characterize the discussions. The combined company will have substantial overlap, and its combined streaming revenue would decline unless Netflix doubles its prices or runs separate platforms, neither of which the brokerage expects, Morningstar analysts have said. Poll shows Trump's approval ratings in New York below U.S. average. Considered one of the big three Democratic strongholds, it's no surprise where New York lands in the latest Civics approval rating of President Donald Trump's second term. According to the report released November 29th, 31% of registered voters in New York approve of the job Trump is doing in his second term, while 64% disapprove and 5% remain undecided. Nationwide, the poll shows that 39% of American voters approve of Trump's performance, 56% disapprove, and 4% remain undecided. This places New York below the national average in support for the president. While New York ranks low, it is not the least supportive state. That distinction goes to Hawaii, where just 21% approve of Trump's job performance, 76% disapprove, and 3% are undecided. Vermont follows with 23% approval and 73% disapproval, and Maryland shows 25% approval and 71% disapproval. On the other end of the spectrum, Wyoming shows the strongest support for Trump with 66% approving, 31% disapproving, and 4% undecided. West Virginia follows at 61% approval and 33% disapproval, while Idaho records 60% approval and 35% disapproval. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. One charged, another in critical condition after attack in motel. A Canandaigua man has been charged in connection with a violent assault that left another man critically injured at the D&D Motel. According to the Ontario County Sheriff's Office, 27-year-old Justin A. Rogers of 4450 County Road 50, Room 1, has been charged with first-degree assault, a Class B violent felony. Court records allege Rogers attacked 53-year-old John D. Kirby during a fight inside Room 1 of the motel, striking him in the head with an axe and causing severe injuries to his scalp and neck. Deputies initially responded to the motel around 7:30 a.m. December 5th after a welfare check call reported a possibly injured man. They arrived with the Canandaigua Emergency Squad and found Kirby unresponsive with a significant traumatic injuries. He was treated at the scene and airlifted by LifeNet to Strong Memorial Hospital, where he remains in critical condition, police said. Rogers was arraigned in Ontario County Cap Court and is being held without bail pending further court proceedings. Officials say there is no threat to the community. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Ontario County Sheriff's Office at 800-394-4560. SNAP funds could be withheld from New York. Certain Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, funds could be withheld from several Democratic-led states, including New York, as soon as next week. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins said in a televised cabinet meeting December 2nd, "It's the latest threat by the Trump administration to hold back SNAP funding as the administration continues its push to receive personal information about the program's recipients nationwide." The potentially withheld funds would not be the benefits themselves, only the funding sent to states to assist with administrative costs of the program. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, later clarified. In response to Rowland's recent comments about withholding SNAP funds, Governor Kathy Hochul said the following in a December 2nd X post. "Genuine question, why is the Trump administration so hell-bent on people going hungry?" Here's what to know. What is SNAP? The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is a federal program that provides low-income families monthly benefits in order to afford healthy food. Over 40 million Americans rely on these benefits, including nearly 3 million New Yorkers. SNAP funding was frozen during the historic 43-day federal government shutdown, which was a first for a federal administration. The spending package that ended the shutdown November 12th restored full funding to the USDA. Demands for SNAP data previously blocked by federal judge. The request for sensitive data on recipients of SNAP, including immigration status and Social Security numbers, was first issued in February before being challenged in court by 22 states plus Washington, D.C. The order was blocked by a California federal judge in October, who temporarily barred the federal government from collecting the information or withholding funds from states that don't provide it. The USDA has until December 15th to appeal the decision, though the judge already said the court would not temporarily pause its injunction in the case of an appeal. The USDA declined to answer questions about an appeal and its compliance with the order. The USDA also told USA Today it had formed a SNAP integrity team to review the data to end alleged indiscriminate welfare fraud. An April 7th report by the U.S. Congressional Research Service described SNAP fraud as rare, saying available data and reports show a large number of overpayments can be attributed to unintentional errors. "We have sent Democrat states yet another request for data, and if they fail to comply, they will be provided with a formal warning that USDA will pull their administrative funds," the USDA said in a statement December 3rd. States challenging the demand have cited privacy concerns, calling it another attempt to amass enormous troves of personal and private data to advance goals that have nothing to do with combating waste, fraud, or abuse in federal benefit programs in the earlier lawsuit. Will I need to reapply for my SNAP benefits in New York? It's still unclear. U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins recently told news outlets all recipients will have to reapply for their benefits in an effort to cut down on fraud. However, in a statement to USA Today on November 17th, the USDA didn't say requirements to reapply were coming. Instead, the agency said it was using standard recertification processes for households as part of further regulatory work to ensure fraud, waste, and abuse are controlled. And the New York State Office for Disability and Temporary Assistance, OTDA, recently told the USA Today network that they haven't received any guidance from the USDA about having all SNAP recipients reapply for their benefits. What to know about other recent SNAP changes? The One Big Beautiful Bill cut an estimated $186 billion from SNAP funding through 2034 and added new restrictions to the program. Under the expanded rules set by the Republican law, all adults age 18 to 64 must work at least 20 hours a week to get food benefits through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, unless they are disabled or qualify for another exemption, such as pregnancy. Those who fail to meet that condition will stop getting aid after 3 months. The law also extended the rules to a broader range of parents with dependent children. Previously, anyone with a child under age 18 in their care was exempt from the work requirement. Now, only those with children younger than 14 are exempt. In addition, the law lifted other exceptions that had been put in place in 2023 for veterans, homeless people, and people ages 24 and younger who were in foster care when they turned 18. And New York State Attorney General Letitia James, along with 21 other attorneys general, filed a lawsuit November 26th to stop Trump from unlawfully cutting off SNAP benefits for tens of thousands of lawful permanent residents as a result of new guidance issued through the One Big Beautiful Bill. Genesee Keg Tree Lighting draws thousands downtown. The annual Genesee Keg Tree Lighting draws thousands of locals and visitors to come enjoy food trucks, beer samples, and the event's signature Keg Tree Ale. The 2025 lighting was successful December 5th at the evening event, impressing the crowd. Beer tents, food trucks, and merchandise tables lined the perimeter of the lot in front of the beloved brewery, where hundreds of people gathered to take part in the iconic celebration. 650 kegs stacked into a tree wrapped in 25,000 lights. When you think of a Christmas tree lighting, you may think of an event where there is traditional Christmas tree with decorations and lights. We do things a little differently in Rochester. The towering Genesee keg tree consists of 650 empty beer kegs stacked in the shape of a tree, wrapped in 25,000 dazzling lights. The crowd counted down from 10, ahead of the button being pressed to light up the beautiful tree. Cheers and applause broke out as the community celebrated the 11th year of this special Rochester tradition. The evening was a kickoff for a celebratory weekend that also included the Liberty Pole lighting and the start of Rock Holiday Village. Aside from marking the holiday season, Keg Tree event organizers are also enjoying a win for being named Newsweek's number one best Christmas tree. And the Pont de Rennes pedestrian bridge closed for a year and a half until December 2024 for repairs and upgrades, was part of the atmosphere again at the Keg Tree Lighting. The bridge, which crosses the Genesee River Gorge from Brown's Race to Cataract Street, came back from repairs with a new deck and railing. Chances often good in New York for a white Christmas. Christmas is nearly upon us and approaching, and much of the country have seen a glimpse or feet of snow already this winter season. but what are the chances of having a white Christmas in New York State in 2025? It's too early for meteorologists to say with much certainty where there will be enough snow to count as a white Christmas. To qualify, according to the National Weather Service, there must be at least 1 inch of snow on the ground on December 25th. On December 5th, about 45% of the country was covered by snow, after recent snowstorms in parts of the Midwest, New England, and Mid-Atlantic. More rounds of snow and Arctic air are expected in the coming days and weeks, according to meteorologists. Though the available data gives us a good idea of the chances of a white Christmas, NOAA says the actual conditions in any year may vary widely from these because the weather patterns present will determine the snow on the ground or snowfall on Christmas Day. Still, historical weather data can give us an idea of the odds throughout the nation, including New York State. With a wide variety of terrain in New York, the probability in securing a white Christmas is also vast. Much of the Adirondacks are typically snow-covered around the holidays, while New York City, although festive, often does not see snow pile up in time for Christmas. Looking at the NOAA map, which is based on U.S. climate normals, the Adirondacks appear to have between a 90 and 100% chance of a white Christmas, while Long Island has less than a 10% chance. Last year, however, New York City had its first white Christmas in 15 years, with an inch of snow on the ground in Central Park. The Weather Service also recorded a snow depth of 4 inches at the Frederick Douglass Greater Rochester International Airport on the 2024 holiday. It's only the second time in 6 years that Rochester tallied enough snow depth to qualify, and the greatest amount since 6 inches covered the ground in 2017. According to the Weather Service, Binghamton has a 67% chance of recording an inch or more of snow on the ground on Christmas Day, based on Weather Service climate records. Historically, there's a 63% chance for Syracuse, a 58% chance for Buffalo, 56% chance for Rochester, and a 46% chance for Elmira, according to the Weather Service. In any given year, your best bet for a white Christmas is in Minnesota, Maine, upstate New York, Idaho, or some of the snowiest mountain ranges in the country, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which produced a map of the probabilities for a white Christmas based on climate data from 1991 to 2020. The least likely spots for a snowy Christmas scene? The West Coast, Deep South, and Gulf Coast, according to the NOAA data. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Fed ends year with a divided outlook. Watchers are predicting third rate cut, division. A contentious year for the central bank is expected by analysts to end with more dissents and uncertainty, two themes that have emerged in recent Federal Reserve meetings. Fed watchers mostly expect a third consecutive rate cut when the Federal Open Market Committee concludes its final meeting of 2025 on December 10th. Still, for those looking to the Fed for relief from high prices, a December rate cut isn't guaranteed. Chair Jerome Powell said as much at the end of the last Fed meeting. Analysts expect multiple dissents alongside another quarter percentage point rate cut. Generally speaking, the Board of Governors has a dovish skew, while all regional federal presidents, who do not all vote, lean more hawkish, Wells Fargo economists said in a December 4th note. While we expect opposition in both directions of the policy decision again, more dissents are likely to be in favor of keeping the policy rate unchanged. Why are federal officials divided? Several Fed officials have cautioned that potential tariff-driven inflation pressures shouldn't be dismissed, according to James Knightley, chief international economist at ING. The economy is still growing. Equity markets are at an all-time high, and unemployment remains very low. So to them, there doesn't appear to be a pressing need to cut rates again, Knightley said to USA Today. However, the more dovish members of the Fed argue that the second part of their mandate, maximizing employment, is looking more challenged. Private sector layoff data, a downbeat assessment on the economy from the Fed's own beige book and New York Fed President John Williams seemingly breaking in favor of a rate cut, add to the case for another cut, Knightley said. As of December 7th, the CME Fed Watch tool predicted the Federal Open Market Committee will lower its target range for the federal funds rate by a quarter percentage point, down to 3.5% from 3.75%. The last meeting of a high-pressure year. John Hilsenrath, a senior advisor at StoneX, said he expects a very divisive December meeting to cap off a high-pressure year. Since President Donald Trump returned to office in January, he has repeatedly attacked Powell in an effort to browbeat the Fed into lowering rates. In April, Trump said Powell's termination cannot come fast enough. Soon, the president may get his wish. While Powell's term on the Fed's Board of Governors expires in 2028, his term as chair will end in May 2026. The president is expected to nominate Powell's replacement early next year. His latest appointment to the Fed, Gov. Stephen Moran, prompted concerns about the Fed's independence as Moran took a leave of absence but did not resign from his role as chairman of the White House's Council of Economic Advisers to join the central bank. The president also attempted to fire Fed Gov Lisa Cook in August over allegations she had lied on two home mortgage applications in 2021. Cook said Trump lacked authority to oust her and that she planned to challenge the move in court, according to a statement from her attorney. In October, the Supreme Court said Trump couldn't terminate Cook immediately and that it would take up the case in January. Trump's abrupt dismissal of U.S. Commissioner of Labor Statistics Erica McInterfer following a disappointing job report also stirred up controversy. Trump then nominated Heritage Foundation economist E.J. Antoni to lead the agency. After economists and lawmakers raised concerns about the quality of BLS data under Antoni's leadership, Trump withdrew the nomination. Most recently, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said he plans to advocate for a requirement that Fed presidents reside in their districts for at least 3 years before they could be appointed to their positions. If not, he said, we're going to veto them. The statistical agencies and the Fed are ending the year with their credibility in question, Hilsenrath said. Trump is prepared to push very aggressively against the Fed, but he tends to pull back a little bit when he sees that the markets get unnerved. Data gap muddles economic outlook. The Federal Open Market Committee is still without recent key economic data, further complicating matters. After the federal government shutdown delayed data collection and dissemination, the BLS canceled the October inflation and jobs report, but said partial data for that month will be included in November reports. It also postponed the November jobs report to December 16th and the November inflation report to December 18th. The latest consumer price index for September showed inflation at 3% higher than the Fed's 2% target. The September jobs report found employers added 119,000 jobs in September, though the unemployment rate rose slightly from 4.3% to 4.4%. Private sector reports have filled some of the data gaps created by the shutdown. A Challenger Gray and Christmas report found employers announced 71,321 layoffs in November, down from 153,174 job cuts in October. The ADP National Employment Report, which is based on payroll data, found private employers shed 32,000 jobs in November. Given how much data will be released before the Fed's January meeting, a Bank of America Global Research report said their economists are skeptical Powell could be credibly hawkish at his December 10th news conference. Powell is unlikely to get away from data dependence, the report said. We wouldn't be surprised if markets start pricing a January cut more aggressively in the near term. Raid on UN aid agency. Israel banned UNRWA operations in October 2024. Israeli authorities entered the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency's East Jerusalem offices on December 8th and raised Israel's flag in a raid they said was ordered over unpaid taxes, but was condemned by the agency as a challenge to international law. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which has been accused of bias by Israel, has not used the building since the start of this year, after Israel ordered it to vacate all its premises and cease its operations. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres strongly condemned the raid. "This compound remains United Nations premises and is inviolable and immune from any other form of interference," Guterres said in a statement. "I urge Israel to immediately take all necessary steps to restore, preserve, and uphold the inviolability of UNRWA premises and to refrain from taking away further action with regard to UNRWA premises," UNRWA Chief Philippe Lazzarini wrote on X that the move by Israel could create a dangerous precedent anywhere else the UN is present across the world. Raid ordered over alleged debt. The Jerusalem municipality said tax collectors had entered the UNRWA compound over unpaid property taxes of 11 million shekels, $3.4 million, after multiple warnings were issued and all necessary procedures were followed. "This is a substantial debt that the required collection after repeated requests, warnings, and numerous opportunities given to settle it, which were not answered," it told Reuters. UNRWA spokesperson Jonathan Fowler said the East Jerusalem compound remained UN premises despite the Israeli ban on its operations, and that the agency had no debts to the municipality. The UN had contacted Israeli authorities several times to remind them of their obligations under a UN convention to which Israel is a signatory, he said. An Israeli government spokesperson did not respond to questions about the raid, but reiterated Israel's criticism of the organization. "We know UNRWA has been a stain on the United Nations," spokesperson Shosh Bedrosian said. Lazzarini said police motorcycles and trucks and forklifts were brought in and communications were cut. IT equipment, furniture, and other property had been seized, he said. The UN General Assembly renewed UNRWA's mandate, first established in 1949, for another 3 years on December 5th. Fowler declined to speculate on the timing of the raid. He said Israel had been conducting a sustained disinformation campaign against UNRWA, whose responsibilities it wants taken over by other UN bodies. Palestinians view UNRWA's existence as enmeshed with the preservation of their rights as refugees, especially their hope of returning to homes from which they or their ancestors fled or were expelled in the war over Israel's creation in 1948. Israel has alleged that some UNRWA staff were members of the Palestinian militant group Hamas and took part in the attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, that killed about 1,200 Israelis and led to Israel's war against Hamas, in which Gaza authorities say more than 70,000 Palestinians have been killed. UNRWA has fired several staff members, but said Israel had not provided evidence for all the allegations against its staff. Israel's parliament passed a law in October 2024 banning the agency from operating in the country and prohibiting officials from having contact with the agency. UNRWA operates in East Jerusalem, which the UN considers territory occupied by Israel. Israel considers all Jerusalem to be part of the country. Israel formally annexed East Jerusalem in 1980 after capturing it in the 1967 Middle East War. The UN and most countries consider East Jerusalem to be occupied by Israel. UNRWA also operates in Gaza, the West Bank, and elsewhere in the Middle East, providing schooling, healthcare, social services, and shelter to millions of Palestinians. Netanyahu will meet Trump on Gaza on December 29th, spokesperson says. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will meet President Donald Trump on December 29th to discuss the next steps of the Gaza ceasefire, an Israeli government spokesperson said on December 8th. On December 7th, Netanyahu said that he will be discussing with Trump the second phase of a U.S. plan to end the war in Gaza later this month. A ceasefire between Israel and Hamas came into effect in October. Both sides have repeatedly accused each other of violating the truce, and wide gaps remain on key issues yet to be discussed under Trump's plan to end the war, including Hamas disarmament, the governance of post-war Gaza, and the composition and mandate of an international security force in the enclave. The Prime Minister will meet with President Trump on Monday, December 29th. They will discuss the future steps and phases and the international stabilization force of the ceasefire plan, government spokesperson Shash Bedrosian said in an online briefing to reporters. The Prime Minister's office said on December 1st that Trump had invited Netanyahu to the White House. Israeli media have since reported that the two leaders may meet in Florida. Trump attacks new CBS owners over Green interview. President Donald Trump on December 8th attacked the new owners of CBS over a 60 Minutes interview with his former ally, Marjorie Taylor Greene, on the same day that CBS owners, Paramount Skydance, launched a hostile bid for media giant Warner Brothers Discovery. The CBS News program, 60 Minutes, on December 7th, aired an interview with Greene, a Republican from Georgia, who in November said she was resigning from the House in the wake of a falling out with Trump. In a December 8th Truth Social post, Trump wrote, "My real problem with the show, however, wasn't the low IQ traitor. It was the new ownership of 60 Minutes Paramount would allow a show to like this to air. They are no better than the old ownership who just paid me millions of dollars for fake reporting about your favorite president, me. Since they bought it, 60 Minutes has actually gotten worse." Trump also demanded a complete and total apology from the show and its correspondent, Leslie Stahl, for what he claimed were incorrect and libelous statements about a laptop belonging to former President Joe Biden's son, Hunter. CBS News did not immediately reply to a request for comment. Paramount Skydance on December 8th made a $108 billion offer for Warner Brothers Discovery. Its $30 per share cash offer includes financing from Affinity Partners, the investment firm run by Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law. Paramount Skydance was formed in August after Skydance Media, owned by David Ellison, the son of Trump supporter and Oracle executive chairman Larry Ellison, took control of Paramount in a deal worth $8.4 billion. David Ellison helped secure regulatory approval for Skydance Media to buy Paramount with the promise that the CBS network would reflect the varied ideological perspectives of American viewers. Prior to the deal, Paramount paid $16 million to settle a 2024 lawsuit Trump filed over a 60 Minutes interview with former Vice President Kamala Harris, which he claimed gave a distorted view of his rival for the White House. Before settling, CBS called the accusations meritless. Russian soldiers jailed for killing U.S. volunteer in Ukraine. Three Russian soldiers were sentenced to up to 12 years in prison on December 8th for torturing and killing Russell Bentley, a 63-year-old U.S. national who had volunteered to fight for Russia against Ukraine. Bentley went missing in April last year near Russian-controlled Donetsk after his wife said he had gone out in the aftermath of shelling by Ukrainian forces. Investigators said the soldiers beat and tortured him to death, then tried to hide the crime by blowing up his body in a car. A military court in Donetsk gave the two soldiers 12-year sentences and a third 11 years. The case embarrassed Moscow, which has encouraged foreigners to fight on its side in Ukraine, and the authorities portrayed the case as a tragic one-off. Ukrainian bloggers described Bentley's death as a warning to foreigners considering joining Russia's war effort. The court said Bentley, who had appeared on state TV to criticize the U.S. government, had been tortured to death in an attempt to extract what would have been a false confession that he belonged to a Ukrainian sabotage and espionage group and was responsible for the missile strike on Donetsk. Nicknamed the Donbas Cowboy, Bentley was featured in a 2022 Rolling Stone article about his transformation from Texas leftist to pro-Putin propagandist. He had obtained Russian citizenship and had done some work for the Russian state-controlled Sputnik News Service. The court heard that the soldiers had found Bentley near a military repairs facility preparing to film the aftermath of the Ukrainian attack. They had disregarded his explanation that he was a journalist, put a sack over his head, and beat and tortured him to death, it said. A photograph of him published in some Russian media on December 8th showed him sitting on a bed next to an assault rifle with a pro-Russian flag, a souvenir from Texas, and a bust of Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin. Russian state TV war reporter Yevgeny Podubny was among those who paid tribute. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump's security roadmap omits reference to North Korea. President Donald Trump's new global security roadmap has dropped any reference to denuclearizing North Korea as a goal, fueling speculation that Washington may be angling to boost the chances of a diplomatic breakthrough with Pyongyang in 2026. The target of ending North Korea's nuclear threat had been a constant in the national security strategy of every U.S. president since the emergence of Pyongyang's program in 2003, but was conspicuously absent in the December 5th document. The omission of any mention of North Korea and its accelerating program to build nuclear weapons that can be delivered by ballistic missiles capable of striking the mainland U.S. is fanning expectations of a potential revival of talks between Trump and Kim Jong-un, last held in 2019. Trump has spoken of his willingness to sit down with the North Korean leader in a proactive way, indicating he wants to get something done by taking some action, said Hong Min of the Korea Institute for National Unification. Then I think there is a certain degree of conscious intent there that the idea of denuclearize really doesn't need to be brought up here, said Hong, an expert on Pyongyang's strategic thinking. In Trump's previous security blueprint issued during his first term in 2017, North Korea was mentioned 16 times as a threat to our homeland and a rogue state that could use a nuclear weapon against the United States. Both South Korea and the United States on December 8th denied there was any policy shift on North Korea, stressing denuclearization remains the goal. Still, Kim has made clear that the issue of whether he could come back for talks hinges on their nature, and that he and Trump would have to meet as equal leaders of nuclear states. The concept of denuclearization has already lost its meaning. We have become a nuclear state, Kim told Parliament in September. I say denuclearization is the last thing to expect from us. If the United States freeing itself from its observed pursuit of others' denuclearization and recognizing the reality wants genuine peaceful coexistence with us, there is no reason for us not to come face to face with it, Kim said. The pair held summits in 2018 and 2019 before negotiations collapsed over Pyongyang's nuclear weapons arsenal. North Korea is under heavy international sanctions over those weapons and its ballistics missiles program. Since the U.S. document release, South Korea has emphasized that it believes the stars may align for the restart of talks with North Korea next year, and that signals from key players ranging from the United States to China and Japan are good. Four things that stood out for Bills. In this final season for the Buffalo Bills at Highmark Stadium, there's been a lot of reminiscing about some of the history we've all seen in the 53-year-old building in the snow belt south of the city. As someone who has been around for all 53 of those years, I've probably seen more than most. And what happened the afternoon of December 7th as the Bills pulled out a stupendous 39-34 victory over the Cincinnati Bengals brought me back 36 seasons to 1990, a Week 4 victory that year over the Denver Broncos that was one of the catalysts in Buffalo advancing to its first Super Bowl in franchise history. That day, the Bills were down 21-9 to a Denver team that was the reigning AFC champion, but they scored three touchdowns in a head-spinning span of 77 seconds in the fourth quarter and went on to a 29-28 victory. On December 7th, we saw a similarly seismic shift in a game that looked destined to become a damaging loss, but instead became a potentially season-changing win. With 8 minutes and 44 seconds left to play on a snow-covered field, the Bills were down 28-18, and many in the somnolent stadium were probably thinking about packing up and heading home. "It was cool to see our fans stay in the fourth quarter," Josh Allen said, remembering the fans who bailed on the Bills on opening night when they looked hopelessly beaten by the Baltimore Ravens before another scintillating rally extricated victory from the jaws of defeat. Those fans who stayed, which to be fair was most in the chilled sellout crowd, were rewarded when Buffalo erupted to score three touchdowns in a span of 4 minutes and 30 seconds, and then held on at the end to secure a hugely important triumph. This one, of course, feels much bigger than that win 3.5 decades ago over Denver, because that one happened in late September, while now, with the calendar having flipped to December, the 9-4 Bills simultaneously kept their slim AFC East hopes alive as they head into a showdown against the first-place Patriots next week at Foxborough and also strengthen their hold on a wild-card berth. "This game had me feeling nostalgic, and Coach Sean McDermott admitted that he was thinking a little about history at Highmark and what it must be like for longtime fans to have enjoyed a victory like this one. I saw a sign before the game on the scoreboard that was reading, 'Get your seat that's full of these memories,'" McDermott said, referencing a plan the Bills are trying to implement to ensure that people can secure souvenirs from the stadium before it gets bulldozed next year. "You think about all the different people who have sat in those seats over the years. Some seats, I'm sure, have stayed in the family through multiple generations, and how special that is, and moments they've enjoyed together. Then all the different people who enjoy Jim Kelly and those guys and now watching Josh and our team. It's just special to be part of it. It really is." Here are a few of my observations. Cook's fumble nearly killed the Bills. There was a reason why the stadium was eerily quiet before the comeback began, with the Bills trailing 21-18, but poised to take the lead on a first and goal play from the 2, James Cook fumbled into the end zone, and DJ Turner recovered for the Bengals. It was a massive gut punch that was then followed by a damaging hook to the head when Joe Burrow cruised downfield on a 12-play, 80-yard drive that ended with his 12-yard touchdown pass to longtime Bills tormentor Mike Gesicki, which made it 28-18. Cook's fumble was his fifth of the season, which is the most in the NFL by any non-quarterback. But Allen said he didn't have to say anything to Cook about it. "No, he understands," Allen said. "I could have helped him out and not pumped the dart and just given it to him right away, so I can take some blame in that." It was actually Cook's second fumble on that drive. A couple plays before, he ran 24 yards for what looked to be a touchdown, but he lost the ball just before he reached the pylon. The play was wiped out by a Buffalo penalty, but not before it survived a replay challenge by the Bengals, who thought Cook might have fumbled the ball out of the end zone, which would have resulted in a turnover. Cook is obviously having a great season, and he chipped in 80 yards rushing and 31 receiving in this game, but he needs to get his sudden fumbling problem under control. He lost a fumble last week in Pittsburgh that gave the Steelers a short field for their lone scoring drive of the game. Allen started and finished comeback with his legs. Allen's response following the Gesicki touchdown is exactly what you'd expect from the reigning league MVP. He threw a 16-yard pass to Terrell Shavers, a 12-yarder to Dalton Kincaid, and after an incompletion, he dropped back for another pass, got pressured, and took off, and the seas parted and not a single Bengal was even close to him on his 40-yard journey to the end zone. That play, the longest touchdown run by a Bills quarterback in franchise history, revived the Bills and set the stage for the craziness that followed. They brought zero. We had emotion and a guy jumping up in the window for my hot. And I just kind of tucked it and felt space and just ran, Allen said. Cook did such a great job of running his guy off and then blocking downfield to spring me loose. You don't get those plays too often, so they're fun. At the end, Allen did it again. Trying to project a 39-34 lead, the Bills were in a tenuous spot. They were faced with 3rd and 15 with 1 minute and 54 seconds to go, and the Bengals still had a timeout to use. If they had forced a punt, Burrow would have had plenty of time to execute a possible game-winning drive. He never got the chance because Allen, who finished with a season-high 78 rushing yards, took off on another scramble, and the Bengals inexplicably allowed him to gain 17 yards to put the game away. There's just no way that should have happened, but that's one of the reasons why Cincinnati's defense has been among the worst in the NFL this season. Well, it was 3rd and 15. You don't expect the quarterback to run there, Allen said. I was expecting zero, so I changed the protection, changed the route from our back, and it just kind of opened up, and I just took off and tried to get a first. Third down defense nearly cost Buffalo the game. During the first half, it was laughable how bad the Buffalo defense was. The Bengals scored touchdowns on their first three possessions, drives of 67, 55, and 69 yards, thanks mainly to their absurd ability to convert third downs. They were successful on all seven of those possessions, including five when they had five or more yards to go. And they weren't just short third downs, they were long third downs, linebacker Shaq Thompson lamented. We were doing our thing on first and second down, but we just got to get it off the field, got to do better to tighten up. I'm not going to make excuses about the weather or the field conditions or nothing like that. We just got to compete out there, and I know the guys will step up and do better. The Bengals failed on their last third down attempt in the first half. But then in the second half, they converted another 3 out of 4 to finish 10 of 12, an 83% success rate that is simply untenable for the Bills. Two of those came on the drive to the Gesicki touchdown, and the last came on a 3rd and 6 throw by Burrow that resulted in a 25-yard touchdown to T. Higgins that cut Buffalo's lead to 39-24 with 2 minutes and 13 seconds remaining. It's always better to get the win so we can go back and learn from it after a win, and we'll learn from it and grow from it, safety Jordan Poyer said. I mean, that's the game, right? I've been in the league for 13 years, and you just keep playing. No matter what happens early in the game, you just keep playing. Defense made up for its struggles. To Poyer's point, that's what the defense did in the fourth quarter as it made massive plays on back-to-back Cincinnati offensive snaps to flip the game. With the Bills still down 28-25, Christian Benford made a great read as Burrow tried to throw a quick slant to Ja'Marr Chase. Benford leaped and plucked the pass with a great grab, then outran the speedy Chase 63 yards to the end zone to give the Bills their first lead. And on that first play after ensuing kickoff, Jordan Phillips tipped a pass and the ball fell into the arms of A.J. Epenesa for an interception at the Bengals 29. And that set up Allen's 3-yard touchdown pass to Jackson Hawes on a fourth down to give the Bills a 39-28 lead. Great plays by them, said Burrow, who finished with 284 yards and 4 touchdowns. Corner blitz and trying to throw a hot reaction, and the guy jumps up and catches it. Great play. The next one, tipped ball, lands right in that guy's hands. Good plays by them. For Benford, it was right in line with the great second half of the season he's having. He has been traveling with the opponent's best receiver, and he did so against Chase, who finished with just 5 catches for 44 yards. And in the last 2 games, Benford now has a fumble return, touchdown, and 2 picks, one being a pick 6. He became the first Bills defender to score touchdowns in back-to-back weeks. I wasn't supposed to jump, like the technique is don't leave your feet, Benford said. But I don't know, God just gave me something for me to leave my feet, and then the rest was history. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 9th issue of the Democrat and Chronicle. Your reader has been Patty Young. Thank you for listening.